This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, online at reformedforum.org. This is the Reformed Media Review, episode number 28. Today, Jim Cassidy and Glenn Clary speak about Volume 7 in Hughes Oliphant Old series, as well as some new resources on Bavinck. All this and more ahead on the Reformed Media Review. Welcome to the Reformed Media Review. This is episode number 28. My name is Camden Busey. Today we're going to be speaking about a few new books from Hughes Oliphant Old, as well as some resources about Herman Bavinck. And as we get into that, let me introduce to you our two hosts. We have Jim Cassidy, who is pastor at Calvary Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Ringgoes, New Jersey. And we're also pleased to welcome Glenn Clary, who is pastor at Emmanuel OPC in West Collingswood, New Jersey. So without further ado, here's Jim with today's episode.
It's a beautiful day here in New Jersey, and we're, although separate locations, glad to be with you all today as we discuss some of the new resources that are out there, hopefully for your edification and for the building up of the Church of Christ. So, Glenn, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you have for us today?
Okay. Well, first of all, I have Volume 7 of Dr. Hughes Oliphant Old's series on the history of preaching. The title of the series is The Reading and Preaching of the Scriptures in the Worship of the Christian Church. And Volume 7 is the last volume in the series, and it covers preaching in our own time. Volume 6 ends with the preaching ministry of Dr. David Martin Lloyd-Jones. And so Volume 7 picks it up from there.
Okay, so basically the latter half of the 20th century.
That's correct. Billy Graham is on the cover of the book, but that doesn't mean that Billy Graham is the one who defines preaching in our own time. But definitely he has had a pervasive influence on preaching in our own time.
Sure.
And he's mentioned in almost every single chapter in the book, actually. There's one chapter dedicated specifically to Billy Graham, but his influence is pervasive.
Sure.
Our readers should know that even though he's on the cover, that doesn't mean that Billy Graham defines preaching in our own time.
Sure, sure. Now, what other than Billy Graham, Glenn, what are some of the other interesting figures that are addressed by Dr. Old in the book?
Well, the book includes several different preachers from different traditions, some of which may very well surprise our listeners. It includes preachers from the charismatic tradition, the Pentecostal tradition, not just Presbyterians, although there is a whole chapter called A New Breed of Presbyterianism, which includes some preachers such as Tim Keller, Calvin Thielman, Earl Palmer, John Huffman, and Sinclair Ferguson.
Oh, that's interesting. Ferguson made it in there, huh?
Ferguson did make it in there.
Yeah, excellent.
And as a rule, Dr. Old has decided not to include any preachers under whose ministry he has sat in the pew. And he wrote this chapter on Sinclair Ferguson before Dr. Ferguson became the pastor of First Presbyterian Church in Columbia, South Carolina. When Dr. Old lives in Columbia, which he does a few months out of the year, he and his wife attend First Presbyterian Church in Columbia. And so they do set under the ministry, the preaching of Dr. Ferguson, but the chapter was written before he, Dr. Ferguson took that call.
Sure. Wow. So, in other words, given his time sitting, as it were, under the ministry of 10th Presbyterian, he doesn't have discussions on James Boyce or, Phil Ryken or something along those types of men.
That's right. He did sit under the ministry of Jim Boyce for around 20 years, but he's not included in the book.
Sure.
Simply because he was sitting under his ministry at 10th Pres.
Yeah, yeah.
Chapter 1 of the book, you may be interested in this, Jim. Chapter 1 of the book is on the end of the main line. I think that's an interesting way to begin Volume 7. think that what the chapter is indicating is that preaching in the mainline church has really come to the end of its day.
Wow.
And he includes such preachers under this chapter as William Sloan Coffin, mm-hmm. Fred Craddock, James Forbes Jr., Fleming Rutledge, and William Willimon. But the end of the main line, I think that's just an interesting way of beginning a volume of preaching in our own time.
Wow, it speaks volumes, that title chapter heading itself, doesn't it?
Right, right.
Wow.
He has a whole chapter on Protestant preaching in Black Africa, which is very interesting. Preachers from Kenya, Uganda, Nigeria, Zambia. So this is all very new to me. I was not familiar with any of these ministers. He has another chapter on liberation theology in Latin America, which is very interesting. Vatican II and American Catholic preaching is another chapter.
That would be interesting as well. Yeah. So it's not. In other words, Glenn, this volume is not a parochial volume. It's not strictly restricted to, or it's not particularly restricted to, you know, white Protestant American preachers.
Right, right. Which is another reason why one shouldn't read too much into the choice of Billy Graham on the cover of the book. The book actually, it probably would have been better if it had ended, or rather if the last preacher of the book was on the cover, and that's Song Bok Kim, who is a minister, Presbyterian Reformed minister in Korea. And that would have said something about the people going to the end of the earth.
Yeah. Now, I think you were going to tell us about another book that Dr. Old is coming out with, one that is forthcoming, however.
Sure. Before I leave Volume 7, however, Jim, perhaps
sure,
I should
yeah.
comment on a couple of other things.
Yeah, please do.
He includes a variety of preachers, as I said earlier, not just preachers from the Reformed tradition. And just because they're included in the book doesn't mean he approves of their theology necessarily. He has a whole chapter on charismatics, for example, Amy Temple McPherson, Oral Roberts, Tommy Barnett, Jack Hayford, and even T.D. Jakes are included in Volume 7.
Interesting.
So he's writing up, you know, preaching in our own time, wherever it is found, however it is done, they're included here, they're represented here. My favorite chapter in the book so far is on the Romanian Revolution and the preaching of Johann Alexandru. This is something I knew virtually nothing about, but Johann Alexandru was an Orthodox, a Romanian Orthodox priest. Living at the time of the Romanian Revolution under the leadership of Ceausescu. And it's a really interesting chapter. In fact, I think if one were to look on Google Books, they can find this book and perhaps read portions of it. And if you can get a chance to read that chapter, it's really great.
How long is this? How large is this volume, by the way? How many pages?
It's around 700 pages.
Okay.
So it's a rather large volume.
It's not for the faint-hearted.
It's not as large as Volume 6. Volume 6 is around 800. Oh, no, about 900 pages.
Whew. So he pulled back a little bit for the last volume.
Right, right.
By 100 pages or so.
What people should be aware of is, just because preachers made the cut into Volume 7 doesn't mean he thought they were necessarily exceptionally great preachers. But they're in there because they're representative of the variety of preaching that is out there today. And so one shouldn't pick it up and be disappointed if his favorite preacher didn't make the book or whatever.
Sure.
He had to draw the line somewhere, and in the book he could have went on and on and on. But he also had to choose those preachers that had a ministry in one location, a pastoral ministry in one location for a length of time where he can get his hands on their sermons. What was available to him was also a factor in determining who who made the book. So Volume 7's out there. It just came out a few weeks ago, and I highly commend it to our listeners.
Excellent. Everybody go out, pick up a copy, and read and enjoy. Of course, you don't necessarily have to have read the first 6 volumes in order to pick up this one and enjoy it.
That's right. You can jump into the series anywhere. Ideally one would start with Volume 1, but that doesn't have to be the case. You can jump into the series anywhere, although the introduction to Volume 1 is really helpful in reading because it sets the trajectory for the whole series. And in the introduction to Volume 1, he maps out where he's going to go in the series, and he talks about the various preaching genres and the schools of preaching that are covered in the whole series.
Good stuff. So what else you got for us then, Glenn?
Okay. Secondly, I have a forthcoming volume from Dr. Hughes Oliphant and Old on communion. And the title of the book is Holy Communion and the Piety of the Reformed Church. And I have a copy of the manuscript. The manuscript is around 800, maybe up to around 900 pages now. And so when it's published, it's probably going to be around 500 pages. The manuscript is double-spaced and so on. But I think it's going to be around 500 pages once it's published. So it's a hefty volume on the Lord's Supper. This is sort of a companion volume to the book on baptism that he wrote a few years back, The Shaping of the Baptismal Rite in the 16th Century.
Which is an excellent book. What a great, great book.
It is. It's definitely the best book out there on the subject of the baptismal rite in the Reformation era, the development of it.
Yeah. If you want to understand what the issues were and what was at stake with regards to the Reformation of worship, particularly baptism, in the 16th century among the Reformers, that comes out very clear in that book. I would commend it to pastors and even lay people who are interested in the subject of baptism and really want to know that the why we do today what we do in baptism as Reformed churches as opposed to what happens in Rome and other communions.
Mm-hmm. Oh, this volume on Holy Communion is a little different in that it traces the history of the practice of communion in the Reformed Church from the Reformation era down to our own day. And so it's a much broader scope historically than his book on baptism, which focuses exclusively on the Reformation era. But the first 200 pages of the manuscript are on Calvin's Eucharistic liturgy, Calvin's Eucharistic theology. And this is the richest material I have ever seen on Calvin's Eucharistic theology. I really think it's going to change our understanding with regard to Calvin's doctrine of the Lord's Supper and his practice of the Lord's Supper. There's nothing out there like this, Jim. I've heard some of these chapters some of the pieces of the chapter on Calvin's Eucharistic theology have been published in the Calvin Colloquium series. Mm-hmm. That used to be held at Davidson College. Now it's held at the Erskine Seminary. But if you know, over the years he has been writing this book. This is a book that's been in the works for many, many years. And a few of the pieces on Calvin's Eucharistic theology have already been published, like the Covenantal Dimension, for example. The Covenantal Dimension of Calvin's Eucharistic theology that just came out in the latest volume on the Calvin Colloquium papers.
Hmm. I was just going to say, Glenn, I'm sorry to cut you off. It's all these things nice to have in this one volume because those other resources may not be the type of stuff that we run into normally or other people run into normally because they're in, you know, scattered here or there, but to have it now combined together under one volume is going to be most helpful.
Right. And there are some that have never been published too.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Sacramental Dimension of Calvin's Eucharistic Theology and the Pneumatic Dimension. The Eucharistic dimension, the eschatological dimension. These are just pieces of chapter two, Calvin's Eucharistic theology. It also covers the communion in the Reformed Church of England under the reign of Queen Elizabeth from 1549 to 1649 is when the first Book of Common Prayer came out. And so this chapter on the Reformed Church of England covers Thomas Cranmer, Nicholas Ridley, Martin Bucer's contribution to the Reformed Church of England, John Jewell, Richard Hooker, William Perkins, and so on. There's a whole chapter on John Knox and the Scottish tradition. Under the Scottish tradition is also included Robert Bruce and Samuel Rutherford. And then there's a chapter on the English Puritans, which covers the Admonitions controversy, Edward Reynolds, Jeremiah Burroughs, the Westminster Directory, Richard Baxter and John Owen, Thomas Doolittle as well. Then there's the Age of Protestant Orthodoxy, covering ministers such as Jean Daillet, a French Huguenot minister, the Netherlands, William Tellink, von Lodenstein, Jodocus von Lodenstein. Many of our listeners may not have heard of him, but he's a very important figure in the history of the church, especially because of his influence on the Great Awakening. There's a chapter on Matthew Henry, and then 18th century Scottish communion seasons, John Willison, the Erskines, Robert Walker, then the Great Awakening, Jonathan Edwards, Gilbert Tennant, Samuel Davies, old school Presbyterianism, Charles Hodge, D.B. Warfield, J.W. Alexander. But he also covers Holy Communion in the age of Romanticism, including figures like John Nevin and Charles Washington Baird. And it goes all the way down to the 20th century with Henry Van Dyke and the Book of Common Worship, and the final chapter of the book is on Jean-Jacques von Alman and the ecumenical approach to the Eucharist. J.J. von Alman was Dr. Old's Dr. Father at the University of Neuchâtel. And so the book has a very broad scope, as you can tell, and it's very helpful. There's nothing out there like it, Jim. It's, I think, going to change the way we understand the doctrine of the Lord's Supper and the history of the Reformed Church and its practice in the Reformed Church.
It is a bit of a technical question, I suppose, but and maybe best left for our listeners to pick up the book and read it, find out themselves. But does he or is there indication within the book that the way we practice the Lord's Supper today has deviated either to a lesser or greater extent than in the 16th century, particularly in Geneva?
Well, the last chapter of the book is entitled Where Do We Go From Here? And it's an evaluation of where we are right now, how we got here, and you know, where are we supposed to go from here? And what Dr. Old wants to do is he wants to draw from the very best in the history of the Reformed Church, not only from the Reformation era, the 16th century, but there is much value, for example, in the communion seasons in the Scottish tradition, the practice of long table communion in the Dutch tradition, the practice of the Lord's Supper under English Puritanism, and so on. So what he's trying to do is to draw from the best of what's gone on the past 500 years in the Reformed Church, and not simply to go back to the 16th century as communion as it was practiced in Geneva, for example. That's not at all what his goal is for the book. But he's not saying either that in some sort of fashion, that this was the ideal age and we have to go back to the 16th century. Mm-hmm. Although it was definitely a great period in the history of the church, and where the reformers rediscovered many essential truths concerning Holy Communion. I mean, like I said, the first 200 pages of the book are dedicated to Calvin's practice of the Lord's Supper and his Eucharistic theology. But anyhow, there's much to be said, too, in terms of value in English Puritanism, in the Age of Pietism, in the Dutch Church, and the French Huguenot Church, and so on. And he wants to draw together the best from all these traditions.
Fantastic. When do we expect to see that on the market?
Perhaps in another year, maybe 2 years.
Okay.
The manuscript is essentially complete. He's adding a couple of more sections to it. He has just recently written up a section on Wilhelmus Habrakel and also another Dutch Reformed theologian, Petrus Emmons, from the 17th century, a contemporary of Matthew Henry. And he's adding a section this summer. He's planning to on Thomas Chalmers. And so once he gets these pieces filled out, the manuscript will be finished, and perhaps it'll go to the publishers next year.
Okay, great. Well, I for one am looking forward to this one, and we'll be keeping our audience up to date as that book draws near to publication and eventually into availability, and we'll be sure to let you know when that comes out. But I'm looking forward to it. It should be a great read.
I just wanted to mention quickly a book on baptism. It's called Baptism, Three Views, and it's edited by David Wright. And the three views the three contributors to the book are Sinclair Ferguson, Anthony Lane, and Bruce Ware. And so the book debates the subject of infant baptism primarily. Sinclair Ferguson representing the Presbyterian view, Bruce Ware representing the Baptist view, and Anthony Lane sort of representing a middle view. But it's a book that has just recently come out, published by IVP, and let's see, 2009. It's a helpful book to read and to give an overview of the debates on infant baptism. Sinclair Ferguson's chapter is priceless. These authors present their view positively, and then they critique views, and then they respond to each other's critique.
Fantastic. Well, another good volume to pick up, and I've heard elsewhere that, in fact, Ferguson's section in that book is quite good. And I remember listening to Ferguson lecture on infant baptism, and he was actually the one who, as I was weighing infant baptism versus believer's baptism, I still wasn't yet a convinced Presbyterian when I took his class, and his lecture was the one that put me over the edge. So I do heartily commend that particular book and Ferguson's contribution particularly. So... well, I have a couple of items here concerning Herman Bavinck I wanted to share with our readers. The resurgence in interest in Herman Bavinck continues, and it is going to be brought forward, Glenn, here significantly, I think, with the publication of Ron Gleason's biography on Herman Bavinck. So that is, I believe, either due out next month or is actually out already in this month. But a little bit about Ron Gleason. He has his dissertation from Westminster Seminary in 2001, and that is actually on the mystical union in the theology of Herman Bavinck. And he has now published... It's June. It is next month as I'm reading the website here. Herman Bavinck, the subtitle is Pastor, Churchman, Statesman, and Theologian. And as far as I know, this is going to be the most extensive English biography of Herman Bavinck. So, again, we would encourage you to pick up this volume and be edified as... Dr. Gleason here unpacks for us the life and the thought and the theology of Herman Bavinck. Another good resource concerning Bavinck that has come out is the recent Calvin Theological Journal, the April 2010 journal, which is all about Bavinck. These articles are a collection of are collected from a symposium that Calvin Seminary held, I guess about this time last year, maybe it was a year and a half ago. I don't remember the exact date, but they're fairly recent. And some of the articles in here that are worth just mentioning in passing to whet your appetite is, well, the first one's by John Bolt, quirky approach to Bovink, I think. But the title of that article is The Bovink Recipe for Theological Cake by John Bolt. And John Bolt, when he speaks about Bovink, we have to listen because he was responsible for the translation, the four-volume translation of his Reformed Dogmatics. So a very important figure, John Bolt, in understanding Bovink and in Bovink studies. So that's the lead article in the journal. Also noteworthy is the article by George Harink, who is a Dutch historian over in the Netherlands, and his article is called Herman Bovink and Gerhardus Voss, which is interesting to map out, an interesting study mapping out the relationship between Bovink and Voss as they were corresponding quite frequently with one another, in fact. So Harink is the one who has a biography on Voss coming out in that American Theologian series for PNR. So Harink knows his Voss, and he also has studied extensively in the history of Dutch theology and Kuyper, Bovink, etc. Harink is an expert in that field. So we commend that article to you. Let's see. Also noteworthy in the journal is an article by David Van Drunen, entitled The Kingship of Christ is Twofold, Natural Law and the Two Kingdoms in the Thought of Herman Bovink. So if anybody is familiar with David Van Drunen's recent literature and writings and study on natural law, here Van Drunen is studying the idea of natural law within the thought of Herman Bovink. So again, interesting article. And one that comes right after it that is also kind of a must read then is by Neil Klusterman, who is a professor out at Mid-America Seminary. Not altogether a big fan of the two-kingdom approach to theology and to the church, etc. And he has a response to Van Drunen's article. So you get Van Drunen's take, and then you can get another perspective from Klusterman. So very interesting discussion going back and forth here among Reformed theologians. So we commend that journal to the listening, to the reading of our listening audience. And lastly, I have, let me open up my internet window here. Calvin Seminary has just released a nice website for Herman Bovink. It's simply called the Bovink Institute. And the subtitle of the website is Promoting Reformed Scholarship in the Tradition of Herman Bovink. And this is a website where a number of contributors get to post information about scholarship concerning Herman Bovink, stuff that Herman Bovink has written, stuff that will be translated, et cetera, et cetera. So it's over the editorship of John Bolt, and again, I commend the website to you. Also embedded within the website are a couple of interesting things. One is a new online journal that Bolt is editing, and it's called simply the Bovink Review, and you can read the articles right there online. It's free of cost, and I don't know where it's going to go from here, but the first issue is already online, and you can find that at the Bovink Institute website. I'll give you the website. It's bovink.calvinseminary.edu. So if you go to that website, or if you just go to the Calvin Seminary website, you can find it, navigate to it from there. But bovink.calvinseminary.edu is the Bovink Institute, and then you can find one of the tabs there is for the Bovink Review, which is the new online journal for Bovink studies. And lastly, one other point on the website that it's worth highlighting is the Bovink Society, also embedded within the website itself. And you can join the society, and you can become part of the scholarship there and be a part of studying and keeping up to date on the recent publications concerning the theology and the life of Herman Bovink. So that's all I have, Glenn.
That sounds really good, Jim. I remember when I was in seminary, Herman Bovink at Westminster Seminary, Herman Bovink was such an important figure for the study of theology, but there was so little out there on him or by him. Mm. I mean, we did not have his four volumes in English. We had Our Reasonable Faith, but it was not a very good edition. Mm-hmm. The Doctrine of God and maybe a couple other small books. But I'm so thrilled to see how much work is being done on Bovink.
Yeah, he's a figure, I think, worth our attention, continues to be a figure worth reading and studying, certainly. And one of the things that is really just humbling as you open up his work and study it, and even as this is a point that comes out time and again within the Calvin Journal, some of the articles there, is Bovink's extensive knowledge of just about everything. I mean, he did, you know, it wasn't, his theology wasn't at all, it's called a Reformed Dogmatics, and it is Reformed, but it's not parochial. It's not narrow, but it does include interacting with current intellectual trends of his day, including science and philosophy and psychology, etc. So he's not synchronizing them, but it's kind of the secular view of things and a Christian view, trying to come up with a third synthesis. But he is interacting with it, and at times he shows where Reformed theology can correct or improve upon those things that are, you know, out there by common grace. So he's very much a theologian who is. Who very much committed to common grace, but also the priority of special grace over common grace. So he's just a wonderful figure to read and to study and to get to know a little bit better. So
he's still held in high regard too, by Dutch theologians. I had a good conversation with Arnold Haugen, the systematic theology professor at the University of Apeldoorn, and also Herman Zelderhuis not long ago. About Herman Bovink, and they both love Herman Bovink, and they still read him today at the University of Apeldoorn.
Yes, that's fantastic. And my experience was kind of like yours as well. We read some of Our Reasonable Faith, a little bit of The Doctrine of God, and those resources were wonderful, and they were rich. But how much more advantage do we have now today, having the four-volume set on Reformed theology? We are spoiled in this generation. So hopefully we will take advantage of it and study Bovink and further the cause of the Reformed faith.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Reformed Media Review. If you'd like to hear more episodes and you're not already subscribed, please visit reformedforum.org. There you can find information about how to subscribe to this program, as well as all of our other programs, including our latest, Philosophy for Theologians. Of course, you can also find us in the iTunes store by going and opening up iTunes and searching for Reformed Forum. You'll see all of the programs that we have going on. If you'd like to get a hold of us, email us at mail@reformedforum.org. You can also Twitter us @ReformedForum, or even send us real mail at P.O. Box 27422, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19118. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Reformed Media Review, and we hope you join us again. But in the meantime, pick up and read. Tola Legge.